Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. We are positively into the June month here. No June swoon around here. And if you are a father, and I've been one for 41 years, you better be thinking about getting pops a gift. In tribute to Father's Day, sports writing, being that I'm a sports writer and that everybody put me on their show when I had a Father's Day Purple Rain 1 and 2 to pimp. I'm going to bring some authors on around here for Father's Day. But before that, we're going to have some crab cakes. We're going to be at a Greenmount Station in Hampstead on Thursday doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery. I will have the Back to the Future scratch-offs in the Maryland Lottery. My thanks to Curio Wellness as well as Liberty Pure putting me out on the road with Raskin Global as well. We will be next Friday at Fadley's at Lexington Market with Luke doing crab cakes. And that's Father's Day weekend. I don't know if John Miller's going to be here next weekend, but he was here for Enoch Pratt doing a book signing. When I tell people I have John Miller on, they're like, "Well, the voice of the San Francisco Giants, who was picking on the Oakland A's last week, the Sacramento A's to you." This is John Miller with the H and the W, the author of The Last Manager. You're more relevant than that, John Miller, because you got brought up to me at Jim Henneman's funeral last week, and the other John Miller did not get brought up because people are reading your book, How Earl Weaver Trick Tormented and Reinvented Baseball. And how are you? I feel like the book's 5 or 6 years old because you've been calling me about that long about the book. And I did the same thing with Joel Poilievre. I'll promote him. I thought his Tom Matty book had been out for years. He's like, "No, it just came out last August." And I'm like, "I feel like I've been talking to you for years that you made the baby, but your book's doing well, dude." A lot of people came up to me and talked to me about how much they love it. I haven't broken it yet. It's a vacation book for me, and I'm thinking maybe the islands in August for me. We got a last place baseball team here. Plenty of time on your hands to get this for Father's Day, right, John?
Yeah, great to see you, Nestor. The book is out 3 months now since March 4th. Made the New York Times bestseller list the first 2 weeks. It's been quite a journey. I have a 5-month-old son. That's pretty intense right now. And I also coach a high school baseball team. So it's been a very busy spring for me. I am going to be in Baltimore June 14th at the Babe Ruth Museum at noon doing a book reading and signing. And I'll close by saying John Miller, the other John Miller, is my hero from when I was a little boy, listening to baseball games in Belgium. My grandfather would send me audio tapes, recordings of John Miller's books or radio. And John Miller read my book and sent me a text message, told me to call him. I called him. We talked for half an hour. A huge thrill. I love that guy.
Everybody loves John Miller. You know, he, I get off topic, but after the whole Angelos thing, he came and did my show when he had a book to sell when he was in Philadelphia as the Giants broadcaster. And just, I mean, it's been 3 decades. And when you say John Miller here, they don't think of you, you know, but they do now. And you're going to be at the Babe. So, I mean, I'm doing the show at Fadley's on that Friday. Open invitation to get a delicious crab cake. Come down. It's a baseball weekend. The Angels in town, like all of that. I, you know, last place baseball and how much this sucks, you know what I mean, for all of us who wanted more. But I would just say this, it's really a tribute to Earl Weaver how hard it is to do what Earl Weaver did, what the old Orioles did, and this is a challenge to Mr. Rubenstein and Katie Griggs and Mike Elias and all of that, because you can draft up the Adley Rutschmans and the Gunnar Hendersons and like all of that, but turning it in to Frank and Brooks and Boog and Louie and Palmer, and then turning that into Belanger and Grich and Baylor, and then turning that into the Senseis and then Eddie Murray and then Cal Ripken. Like, it's really hard to do. And you get books written about you when you've done it for as long as Earl Weaver did it. And now, all these years later, a guy like you comes along and says, "What made Earl tick?" And I guess that the beginning of our relationship was I did the last ever interview with Earl Weaver
You did.
before he passed away.
It was
And I
great.
kind of asked him what made him tick. And like you really went into what made him tick.
Well, I was looking around if I have a copy of the book. You have it, but look at the early pages of the book. I have a chart where I say, before Earl, the Orioles averaged like 77 wins a year, a season. After Earl, 79, 80. During Earl, it was like 95 wins a season. I mean,
Page seven here. Here it is. Page seven. Is that
there you go.
this
An
is what you
incredible,
want right here, right?
an incredible leap under Earl. I mean, what made him so great? That's really the central question of the book. What makes a manager great? Because he won with all kinds of teams, like you just said. Like he won with Frank and Brooks Robinson and Boog Powell and Jim Palmer. He won with Rich Coggins and Al Bunbury. He won with John Lowenstein and Tim Stoddard. He won with anybody and everybody. He was a winner. And that's what makes him a folk hero in Baltimore. And I think they missed that kind of leadership. I mean, look at all the comments after Brandon Hyde was fired. People saying, can't we get another Earl Weaver? Because he was clearly this great leader. And for all the analytics, people still need that great human leadership. They need somebody saying, you know, you're not playing well enough. You got to play better. Come on, play better. They need that raspy little guy in the dugout shouting at them.
The book itself and the story is a run folks through that have not listened to you and me blather on for years about what this book was going to become. And I've really only had you on one time since you finished the book where you knew what it was, not just a bunch of stories in a tapestry. The book is now its own thing. What would you say is the synopsis and thesis of it? Other than I'm thinking from the outside after hours of speaking to you about this, that it really is looking at what made him think the way he thought, right?
So Earl Weaver was an underdog hero, which made Baltimore fall in love with him. He grew up in the streets of St. Louis, rough and tumble childhood. His uncle, his mentor, was a mobster, a bookie, who ran illegal baseball betting operations. He grew up with a kind of street hustler's wit about him, a way of always looking for an edge, always looking for a hustle, taking the trolley to baseball games, living in the city, walking to baseball games. He was a much better player than people remember. He signed at 17 with the Cardinals, played 4 years in the minors, and was a team MVP 3 of the 4 seasons. Earned a spring training invite to Major League Baseball spring training in '52. Played with Sam Musial, with his childhood heroes on the Cardinals. Did really well. Hit 260, a couple home runs, good defense, but was a cut by his own manager Eddie Stanky, who wanted himself to be the backup infielder. And that rejection really drove Earl to despair. To drinking, to this kind of chip on the shoulder that people came to know in Baltimore. He then spent 16 years in the minor league, 16 years before he got to the big leagues as a first base coach for the Orioles, took over in the All-Star break of 68, and immediately won. They had a winning season the rest of the year. They won 108 games, or 109 and 68, 169, 108 and 70. Still the only team in baseball history with back-to-back 108 or more win seasons. Won 5 of the first 6 American League Championship Series, or AL East titles, sorry. And then just kept on winning. And again, this kind of chip on the shoulder, underdog hero, that's what makes Earl Weaver famous. That's what made him a winner. You know, fought with everybody, but just kept on winning. And, you know, when he retired, you know, regarded as still maybe the greatest manager of all time by some reckonings. You know, he still has the highest winning percentage of any manager, with over 1,000 wins since divisional play started in 69. And he's in the Hall of Fame for a reason. And he's a Baltimore folk hero for that reason, too.
You know, I got Barry Trotz coming on right after you. And, you know, I've known Barry since we were kids. And I started to look up, like, yeah, he's going to the Hall of Fame. You know that. They won the Stanley Cup. I was there. Did all of that. And I looked him up. He's like number 4 on the wins list in the history of the National Hockey League. So kind of like, wow, that's, you know, and you talk about Earl in that rarefied air of all the championships and the lost ones and the funny videos and all of that. Is there a place archivally that you found him in his voice talking about these issues of what made a great baseball player and even anything introspective into what made him successful in his own mind? What if you could channel him even in his own voice and say, what would if you say, or what made you a Hall of Famer? What he'd say, good ball players. I can hear that, right? But
Yeah.
what made him in
Well,
his own mind good or different or belong as this little guy who was smarter and better and tougher than anybody?
that's a great question. That's sort of where I started my reporting. You know, my first phone call was to his stepdaughter, Kim, who still lives near Baltimore. You probably know Kim Benson. And I thought maybe Earl has like a diary or a journal or letters. He had none of that. So I had to look at newspaper clippings. You know, he would give press conferences, interviews a lot. Mike Gibbons at the Babe Ruth Museum had this old collection of interviews that they had done within the Orioles that had never been published, never been heard, where Earl talks about
Unlike the
cultivating.
Tom Maar Norfolk and Alice,
Yeah,
right?
no,
That
no,
that's
no,
been
no.
well heard. Yes,
Yeah,
yes. By the way,
yeah,
that one made it to me. I was on the radio in 1991. By 1992, somebody had dropped that tape off at the radio station
yeah.
just
Well,
so I
that's in
had
the, I tell the backstory of that famous interview in the book,
it.
as well as the Bill Haler hot mic incident. So you know, a lot of little things here and there. And then, of course, Nestor, your interviews with Earl were great, as he was dying basically the last year of his life, and had a sort of this, lost the filter of what he should say and was just kind of speaking from the heart. But he was a complicated guy, as you know, and he wouldn't always tell the truth about himself or about what had happened. He never really told the story of how great a prospect he had been. He was always said, I wasn't a great player, and I really wanted to be a player, but I wasn't good enough. Well, it turns out he probably was good enough, but he probably drank too much and probably dug his own grave as a player in the 50s with the Cardinals and wore out his welcome and made some mistakes. He never really owned up to that. And his story was told. I mean, he wrote three books in the 70s and 80s. He never told the story of his mobster uncle, who was his favorite uncle, but was kind of a mean and violent guy who shot his wife during an argument in the hip, whose first wife died of gas asphyxiation. He told the cops it was a suicide. This was kind of a nasty guy, and he was kind of the darker part of Earl's childhood. I mean, Earl's dad was a good guy, was a business owner, was somebody who Earl could look up to. His uncle was not, but that's who Earl spent a lot of time with. So Earl's, the more violent side, when he would say to the umpire, "I'm going to knock you right on your ass." I think that came from Uncle Bud. And Earl never really revealed that. That was something for me to dig up in newspaper clippings and family interviews and to tell the story that he was not willing to tell.
Why are you obsessed with Earl Weaver and writing this?
Because he was a winner and because I'm an Orioles fan, and I became a fan in the late 80s when they sucked. And so I wanted to know what made them so great in the 70s. And Earl seemed to have something to do with it. And then he was just so much fun and funny. I read his memoir when I was 10 years old. It's what you learn after you know it all that counts. And the stories of the fighting and the just
I
the
haven't
wit,
read Earl's books, or
the
I mean,
humor.
I held one of them. I think I took a picture and sent it to you because it was signed. I'm a little bit of a thrift, not a thrifter, but like a secondhand.
Yeah.
I collect Pacifica belt buckles. I collect old NFL belt buckles and stuff. So I
By the
look for
way, yeah.
silly stuff, you know?
If people don't like to read on the page, the audiobook version, this is a actor from Chicago, Johnny Heller, did an incredible job. He has like a 1930s like crime noir voice. And if you have Spotify, it's free on Spotify.
So
So
listening to your book's also possible.
it's incredible. Yeah, it's a great audiobook. Yeah. And so if you have Spotify, just put it on your car trip, listen to The Last Manager. You don't have to pay anything extra. And it's also Audible or whatever, however
So it's
people
a
listen to
podcast, essentially. It's a
it's a
podcast
podcast.
story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well,
So you can do it.
but these other books that were written by him or co-written, they're a little like of the era, you know, like of the era. They're not like the same. It's not Bouton in ball four, right?
No, he's not confessional. I mean, I guess he tells stories about he corked his own bats, but it was only like the Playboy interview. He talks about how the Orioles used amphetamines in the 70s, and in his books, he doesn't talk about. So there's a famous Playboy interview with Earl from '83, and there he dishes a little more. But in the memoirs, no, he's mostly about baseball strategy and about his own apprenticeship in the minor leagues and his own baseball philosophies.
Would Earl hate the book?
Earl's this is a answer to that question with a story, which is I got to know Earl's family. His grandson in St. Louis is a character who goes by Clownvis. You would love him, Nestor. He's a singer. His act is half clown, half Elvis impersonator. And so I went to a Clownvis show with Earl's daughter. And by the way, Clownvis was on America's Got Talent and got into a shouting match with Piers Morgan, one of the judges, and was kicked off the stage. And he was, yelling at the Piers Morgan. And when Earl died, Clownvis wrote this piece saying, "I was channeling you, Grandpa, and I used to fight with umpires." So Earl's daughter Terry and I were at this Clownvis show at this club in St. Louis in February 2023, and we're both having a few drinks. And at one point, Earl's daughter turns to me and she jabs me in the chest, and she's like, "I've been thinking about what my dad would think about what you're doing with your book." And I thought, "Oh my God, she's gonna like, this is Earl's a ghost gonna talk to me here." And I said, "Okay, Terry, what would he say?" And she said, "I think he would say, if you feel that this is something that you need to do for you, then you go ahead and do it, but you just make sure that it's good." And I was like, oh my God, Earl, even from the grave, is pushing people to be better, is coaching me to be a better writer. You know, that's the power of Earl Weaver's obsession with quality and his coaching. And so I think he would respect the work that went into the book. I think he cared about quality, and I think he cared about hard work. And I think he would respect that I did my best and that it turned out to be a pretty good book.
I miss Earl. So the fact that you have this book and it will be a gift to me at some point, you'll see my toes in the book and blue water and hopefully some sand because I don't really do pools so much. I don't like sand, but I like beaches. I don't, you know what I mean? So, but I'm going to take this to a beach. The last manager, how Earl Weaver trick tormented and reinvented baseball. John W. Miller, the old Wall Street Journal. Them journalists, they always looking into things, getting to the backstory of things that are going on out there. He'll also be down at the Babe Ruth Museum on the 14th, Father's Day weekend. Is there anything you want to say about the, I mean, you're dying with the Orioles like everyone. I mean, can we put the book down for a minute and like get to like what the hell's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm disappointed this year. I thought they'd have a much better season. It's not rocket science that they needed more starting pitching to start the year and had a bunch of injuries and were not able to cope. I mean, but the real story really is these young players like Adley Rutschman and Ryan Mountcastle and why they're not playing better. And I think a good manager might help unlock that. And so I think Brandon Hyde is obviously very smart and was very respected and beloved by his players, but maybe they need a little more fire and a little more tough love and, somebody to tell them that they stunk when they stunk.
That's what we were for. That's what the reporters are for, right? Am I right or am I wrong, right?
Now, reporters are there to tell the truth and to fight, figure out what's going on, but players, don't really tell them anything anymore. So it's pretty hard to be a baseball writer these days.
Yeah, I got out of that business. We'll get back into that business here. John Miller is here. The book is out. And so I want to ask you this. The book comes out. You're a New York Times bestseller. I don't know. I want to pay whoever you're paying to get on that list. I mean, but this obviously has been a real serious passion project for a number of years. Baseball season, doing it at the right time. The Orioles were doing well. There is a point where baseball managers, to your point, even Brandon Hyde, you'd say, well, how much is he really managing? How much is the philosophy of the structure of the analytics of the situation managing it? In the same way, you don't really play blackjack. You play the hand that you play the hand and whatever the book tells you to play at blackjack. Since the book came out, you're getting a lot of feedback in a lot of ways. I'm seeing you doing these kinds of interviews and different stuff. What are you hearing from industry people, because I was at Jim Henneman's funeral last week. I think three or four different people came up to me. One of my old editors at the Sun, first thing he said to me, I heard you had John Miller on and I bought the book and the book's great. The book's unbelievable. So you're getting a lot of that when people go into this, even people who thought they knew a lot about Earl, old school Oriole fans, that I guess that's why people were buzzing about it last week. What are they feeding back to you that they're shocked by when they read it?
Well, I got some calls from people who are in front offices now saying, we're having everybody in the organization read your book because there's still some insight, some wisdom. I think people missed how fundamentally sound or I guess what his actual baseball strategy was. Earl Weaver is famous for the pitching defense and 3-run homers and famous for hating the bunt. Well, it turns out the first half of his career, the Orioles actually bunted more than league average because they had Mark Belanger, who was a terrible hitter, and he bunted it a lot. And they had this team in the 73, 74 with Rich Coggins and Al Bunbury that I know that's a team that you fell in love with, Nestor. And that team, stole a lot of bases. And so these don't fit the cliche of waiting around for the 3-run homer that people believe about Earl. And that my book really makes clear that he was a lot more nuanced about baseball strategy than people give him credit for. Particularly, it comes to throwing strikes. I mean, he really believed in throwing the ball down the middle and the ball probably ended up on the corners anyway, and then changing speeds. And that's kind of where baseball philosophy is today. And so he was very much a prophet ahead of his time. And I think his leadership qualities are qualities that still carry over today, that he was a great leader of men because he really cared about the things that mattered. And that's what leadership is. And he didn't hold grudges. And even if he was kind of a mess and, he struggled with alcohol and he would pass out in the lobbies of hotels and be picked up by his players. And even though they had to deal with that, the next day he was always there ready for the game. And he really cared about the outcome of the game. Mike Flanagan said he made you feel like the game was important. And I think that's what a great leader does. He makes you feel like your work is important And that's why the Orioles played so well under him, because he gave every game this sense of importance, of motivation for the players to do the best because the games mattered.
Thing I took out of that, something you said kind of early on about putting people in a position of their strength and weakness and identifying that and not having your ego held to that. And that would be in the case of, in my era, Rich Dower and Billy Smith sharing second base, and Frank Baker being a leftover guy, sort of that they needed sometimes when Mark Belanger couldn't go and DeCinces and Brooks was getting old, and all of that period of time. And then there's Reneke and Lowenstein. And then there's the bullpen in general, where Palmer was going to throw a complete game, but you didn't want certain nights, guys only had six, seven innings in them. It was going to be a bullpen effort. It wasn't about how many at bats you were getting, how many runs you drove in, whether you're Pat Kelly coming off the bench or Terry Crowley, who usually joins me when I see him up at Greenmount Station. I'll be there this week because he lives up in Carroll County and he still lives here in the area. Incredible pinch hitter that Earl could identify roles for Jim Dwyer's and Benny Ayala's and whomever to be productive, to be the best they can be, and help the team win, even if they only got 214 at bats a year. Everybody couldn't be Frank Robinson. Everybody wasn't going to be, Brooks Robinson or Eddie Murray, but you could be, you could have a role on the team and feel a part of it. I guess as a kid, I felt that, but managing all of this in an era where you're managing money and salaries and egos and free agency, and it's a lot more complicated. And I guess to Earl's point, and to people reading your book and saying, "How can I bring that to my organization?" He held it together over 2 decades in a way where the Mike Elias era here is sort of teetering in modern day baseball. It's just a really, really hard thing to do, win for long stretches of time and manage as much as going on and try to not have and he didn't mind hurting people's feelings though, right? Different era in that way that I don't know that Earl could come back and do. I once interviewed Frank Cush, and the first thing he said to me was, "They gotta fear you. If they don't fear you, they're not gonna play." And I'm thinking, man, that wouldn't play. Would Earl's management play today? Things would have to be a little. He couldn't be drunk in the lobby. Let's start with that,
He'd
right?
have to get sober for sure. I mean, I think he'd still be good at some important parts of the current job. One of those is triaging information. I mean, front offices produce all this data and analytics, and some of it's useful, some of it's not. And it takes somebody with a smart IQ for sorting out information that Earl had. Earl had a gambler's mindset where you take a lot of data information, then you put it all together, and you make a decision that's a simple decision, yes or no, basically. Is this guy going to pinch hit or not? And he could use that information, I think, really well these days. He was the first manager to use a radar gun. He was not afraid of innovation. He was not afraid of change. He was not afraid of taking a new approach to something. And so I think he would have been really good at helping young athletes come up or understand how to use information to their advantage.
What
And he would
made
have been a
him
great.
that way?
What's that?
What made him that way? It was it because Sig Meidel would say growth mindset, like an Astro ball. Was growth mindset for him winning a bet? Was it corking a bat? Was it just sort of like just winning? Like got to be like even in Trump's case, cheating, right? Like just sort of like obsessed with the only way I'm going to win is to get better. That or even if I have to cheat, even if I have to whatever I have to do, but I got to get better. I got to be working on it. I got to be thinking about it. There's an obsession about that I don't know that's very modern, in that way, right?
I think gambling, I think he loved cards, he loved poker. He used to take his teammates' money at poker until 3 or 4 in the morning, and when he became a manager, he said the first thing I'd do is give up poker because I figured I couldn't inspire people if I was just taking their money all the time, because he was such a good poker player. And he just was obsessed with competitiveness. He loved, ping pong on the cruise ships or whatever. He just loved to win. And he also, in his younger days, he cheated. He had corked bats in the minor leagues. He had Pat Sannereau experiment with putting mercury in bats to see if that could give the Orioles an advantage. And the Orioles were never caught cheating under Earl, but Pat Sannereau did experiment with cork bats at Earl's orders. So, yeah, always looking for an edge, always looking for a way to beat you, to hustle you, to take your money. And you're right, it's kind of old fashioned, but that's the culture he grew up in. I mean, but now you have like DraftKings and FanDuel, taking people's money out in the open, I mean, I would submit to you that they're probably not any better.
On our next conversation, John Miller will join us about whether Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame or not. John Miller's book is out. It is there's been a lot of advanced praise. George Will, Ken Burns, you got some. Didn't ask me for a cover, but I you know I, at least I feel like I contributed in some way, and I am indebted to not just Earl for spending time with me, but Dick Gordon, who was also Luis Aparicio's agent, as well as Tiant and Yastrzemski and a whole bunch of other people as well. Dick set up that last interview with Earl Weaver. If you want to see me and Earl and my wife holding a camera down at the Harbor Court Hotel on the weekend of the final statues, it was late in that summer. It was like an August, and Earl gave me 10 minutes that turned into a half an hour, and it turned into my relationship with John Miller and his obsession with this crazy book. Go get it for Father's Day or there or after. How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. I honestly, man, I've been doing this a long time. I have not had a lot of authors come on over the course of time like you that we've genesis this relationship from Pittsburgh to here as you've birthed this book. But how many people have come up to me and told me how universally they've loved the book? And so I'm really happy for you. I'm thrilled for you. I hope a million people buy it. And
Thank you.
and this is fun coming down to Baltimore and like BSing with people, even though the team's in last place. But there
Yeah.
is a guiding light here to say what it could look like, right? This is what it should
Yeah,
look like,
yeah.
right?
And I'm not giving up hope on the Mike Elias Orioles. I think they can still turn it around. Maybe not this year, but they still have a lot of talent.
Any fact that Elias is reading the book here and trying to channel his inner Earl or no?
I was in touch with Sig Maydow in reporting. I don't know. I imagine that they've all at least looked at it. We've sent copies to David Rubenstein, and he's a Simon and Schuster author too, you know, and I'm sure they've looked at it. Yeah.
So if you want to do really good theater, man, you and I could get on a stage somewhere and promote your book. I could ask questions and you could answer them as Earl, and it would just be, Earl, I know you're coming back from the dead, but
There's
there
a
was
guy
a.
who has a great Twitter Blue Sky handle, Earl Effing Weaver. And I'm in touch with him, and
Let's get him in on it. It
he's
could be
pretty great,
we
yeah.
could totally do shtick with this for charity. But like Earl, there was a team in Houston that won a World Series beating trash cans in their dugout, cheating. You know, what would Earl make of that? You know, I mean, that would be something, right?
I think you would say they were dumb and getting caught. I think Earl would have approved of sign stealing.
The unwritten rules we now find. John, good luck with the book. Keep doing great work. And are you doing anything else other than coaching Little League, promoting the book, and like being a father of 5 months? Are you working on another book, I'm asking?
No, I'm just doing magazine writing. I'm starting a beer column for the local paper here soon. Just doing journalism.
In Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh,
P
beer?
Pittsburgh. Yep.
Yinz in that. You're going to have something better than
I'm
IC? IC Light.
from, I grew up in Belgium, so I have high standards for beer.
Well, some people grow up in Latrobe. They have different standards for beer. John Miller, the author of The Last Manager. Go check it out. Always a great guest, always insightful. And the Oriole way, and the Earl Weaver way, and a summer where. Got plenty of time on your hands, especially with the Orioles on the West Coast this week. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Happy Father's Day, everybody out there celebrating. Give them a good book for Dad.